Hello, everyone, and welcome to Show 40 of the Retro Computing Roundtable. That's the RCR. We're recording live on Sunday, December 9th. But no matter where I go, there's one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? How about that? 40 shows. All right.
Awesome.
Hey. The RCR is hosted by CyberEars, and they can host your podcast or audio files, too. Go to cyberears.com for more details. I'm David, I'm back, and I'm hosting today. Plus, Earl is here, of course. Carrington had a last-minute scheduling conflict, and so he is off on some work adventure or another. And what a real slacker he is, huh? So in his absence, we got an emergency Canadian on the job, a former and brilliant RCR panelist. It's Derek Warren of Vancouver, Canada, right?
That's true, although that is a bit of a stretch, although I was a former panelist.
I think you're on the show at least three times.
I think it was at least twice or three times.
Yeah. So Derek is, I guess, more of an app, you know, into computer history by way of Apple, the Mac especially.
By way of Apple, but also the big on the Atari scene, and over the last few years as a foreigner, gotten into the BBC Micro.
Cool.
I just discovered that the guy behind the Raspberry Pi project is none other than David Braben. Now, do I have to ask you guys, do you know who David Braben is?
No. Did anybody play
Elite on their ZX Spectrum or Timex Sinclair or Commodore 64?
No.
I haven't played it. I have a friend of mine who told me that it was the bomb.
So David Braben is the guy behind Elite. And he's also the guy behind Raspberry Pi. So Elite is famous on the BBC Micro not only for being a cool space resource and trading game, not that I've ever played it, but famous on the BBC Micro for switching from medium to high resolution halfway through the screen in no memory.
I've seen a show about the game, and I haven't watched that show in a while. It's on YouTube. The guy who does the video shows about old games. Brilliant. You guys don't know what I'm talking about? I know we've talked about it on the RCR before. Now I feel bad. I can never remember. My memory's going. Neither of you guys, you know what I'm talking about?
We need to replace your cores, David.
I'll look it up while I move on.
The cooling oil for your core memory, David, is going.
It's bad.
Sitting outside is not good. It's not cutting.
I used to watch it all the time, so I guess I'm behind on it. Well, Earl, anything? So thanks, Derek, again, for being on the show. Also, Derek is well known for the Mac Folklore Radio. Podcast, which is, I know you haven't done it in a while,
which
but
is
it's
so dead that I had to go scrambling for the microphone that's been sitting in the closet for 3 years.
But you know what? It's still out there and it's still great content, especially anybody who's never heard it before. And I've re-listened a couple times. So on to you, Earl. What's new?
just hanging out, doing the holiday thing. When we get to the closing session, I'll talk about Retro Day that I had with my daughter yesterday. It was a lot of fun. But Portland weather in December is kind of gloomy, so you wind up doing a lot of indoor stuff. And I also wanted to say thank you to Derek for joining us here at the last minute, because we had a last-minute bow-out from Carrington, and it's wonderful to have a three-person show.
I also got to say thanks, because Earl, I just found your interview with Stuart Chaffee the other day.
Oh, that was an enjoyable one. I really loved talking to him. It was kind of fun talking to somebody who's so used to being behind the camera or behind the microphone that it was almost no work at all. You just kind of nudge him in the right direction, and we talked about all kinds of fun stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, I have the two-parter saved. So show 134, 133. Yeah, excellent. I'm surprised no one had talked to him recently until you did it, as far as I know, anyway.
He's so influential.
Oh, yeah, this is great. I still rewatch a lot of those shows. So we're going to get right into it. Basically, I'm back. I took a little leave of absence, Derek, from the last couple of shows. Kind of took a rest and got some other parts of my life together. So now I'm back. And then Carrington takes off. So I guess a couple of shows, Earl will take off.
Well, the rumor was that you kicked Carrington off the show.
Right. We toyed around the idea of, like, me coming back going, like, I fired Carrington.
Yeah. Or send him to go break ground on your secret visitor center.
right.
My fellow Canadians, Carrington is from Toronto, so I think we can all agree that Carrington was kicked off for personal reasons.
Yeah, Earl, don't bring that up. I don't even think I'm like a fanatic about it.
Yeah. You Apple fanboy, you.
So, Earl, take it away. You have the first item of interest this show.
Okay.
Tell us about it.
Well, imagine, if you will, that you could take a high-tech company in the 80s and freeze it in time. And all of a sudden, it's 2012, and you walk into the office, and everything is as it was back in the 80s, including the computing technology. Wouldn't that be cool? It turns out that that actually happened in Silicon Valley here. I was just bringing up the link to get the exact coordinates here of this. But there was a company called Ideographics, and they made a solution that enabled Chinese characters to be easily manipulated and printed and worked with in computing, which up to that point had been a tremendous challenge. And any time you wanted to print something from computing with those kind of characters, it would have taken so much human effort to do it. So it actually was a really cool solution. Of course, as computing progressed and the support for character sets became more robust, the technology, as all things, became obsolete. But the company itself remained kind of frozen in time. And so there's an article about this in the Mercury News where they walk through the office and they can still see remnants of the past, like the decor of the office is from the past. The ashtrays are still in the office. There's a VAX 11750 that's sitting there. So so it's just like a snapshot in time. And they have a couple of pictures that you can take a look at in the article, too. I think it's a good read. And it's also, they talk about how there were a lot of innovations in Silicon Valley that didn't get a lot of press at the time. They were very exciting, but now they've been eclipsed because there's only so much that you can preserve in popular history. And so everyone thinks about the past of Apple. They think about Microsoft. They think about a couple of the other companies like Mosaic Browser and that. But so much of history has been just lost to the annals of time. So this was an interesting little time capsule here, and I think people ought to take a look at the article.
A couple of things I'd like to jump in with. First of all, if you're curious about the microcomputer market in the early 80s and Japanese characters and why Japan didn't completely take over the microcomputer market in the 80s, which everybody was expecting to do since they had with electronics and cars and all that, again, Stuart Chaffee, there's a Computer Chronicles episode about PCs in Japan that I recommend people look at. It was interesting that Asian languages and ideographic languages were actually one of the barriers to Japanese dominance of the PC industry. You just couldn't get Asian characters in a, strangely, in an 8-bit sized machine.
Mm.
Saved by English.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the other thing is it bad that the first thing when I see this article, the first thing that I think is not, wow, what a frozen moment or place in time, but rather the first thing I think is, oh, somebody's got to get in there and replace all those capacitors.
I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
Yeah, well, do we know why it was left like this? I haven't gotten to read the article, obviously.
Well, apparently, the son of the main person behind the business says that the father likes to keep things, which the person who wrote the article regarded as a significant understatement. But other than that, there's not a lot of background in why the office has been preserved the way it is.
Yeah, it's great with the couple of different paint jobs on the walls and stuff. Yeah, those ashtrays, I remember seeing those all the time.
Sure.
A long time ago.
When I worked at Hughes Aircraft in the 80s, it was okay to smoke in the offices.
Oh, yeah. I know, that is so foreign now.
Oh, I would have died.
And I watched some videos recently of NASA from back in the 60s, mm-hmm. and they were smoking in mission control.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I take it they didn't have a lot of hard disks in that particular office.
Yeah, probably not.
Well, the deal is, I think the only place you flat out were not allowed to smoke would have been in the computer room.
The actual data center, right.
The big, right. There, no way. Then you couldn't. But everywhere else you could. So really, the computer itself is kind of removed from the environment. You're just using the interface, you know, teletypes and all that kind of stuff.
That's
terminals.
True.
But yeah, it's great. Yeah, the whole we could have a long discussion about smoking because you know, a lot of my earliest work was as a waiter in the 80s. And of course, you know, do you remember smoking in restaurants?
Oh, and absolutely.
Yeah, now it's just such a foreign idea.
Smoking or non-smoking? Oh, yeah, we're going to sit over there in that section where the smoke goes do-do-do-do. Oh, that's a non-smoking section. Better back off.
Well, and then before that, there was just smoking. There wasn't any non-smoking area.
Well, I didn't live I'm too young to remember that era, but I do remember when I was in
the first question. Everywhere was smoking. It was like, you know, really old days.
Speaking of clean air, people who are listening on the audio, of course, can't see this, but David, you're outside.
Oh, yeah, I'm in my backyard. I've been wanting to do this.
In short sleeves, fellow Canadians.
Yeah.
In short sleeves.
In a T-shirt and here, let me see. What's the temperature? So if I can bring it up real quick. Come on, fill in. 70 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
There's going to be a low of 54 here.
Derek, I guess that's probably my high.
Yeah, I'm just Googling that right now. 70 degrees 2 Celsius.
Right, sorry.
About 20 degrees. Oh, that's pretty nice.
Oh, did you get it? Okay. Yeah, it is very nice out here. It's kind of cloudy and slightly overcast, but just really nice. It's nice to be outside. Don't get out here enough. So we're going to move along now. The next article, our piece we'll talk about is from American Banker site. It's called "This Piece of Cardboard Launched a $1 trillion Industry." So there's an upcoming auction at Sotheby's, and they're selling basically the prototype of the first magnetic credit card. And I just thought it was something interesting. To be honest, it seems to be a bit of a slow, especially retro computing news, you know, week or 2 weeks.
It is, but, which is odd because we're coming into the holiday season. Usually that's a pretty busy time.
But I found this, and obviously it's computer history. You know, the whole magnetic strip of credit cards obviously is a huge part of our economy and our culture and our way of living. Another big innovation, of course, was on checks. You know, the magnetic printing of
Irma.
The account
the
numbers
microline.
And all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Irma, right? Is that what you said, Derek?
I see we've all seen the same set of documentaries.
What's called,
this is a good podcast to be on.
Which was Bank of America, I believe, right? But that made it where, you know, machines could read the checks versus people, and that was huge. And, of course, computers. But anyway, it's a short little article, but it just talks about that the card itself is estimated to be valued between $10,000 and $15,000. So it'd be kind of curious to see what it goes for. I think the auction is in let me link off real quick. I believe it's in a week. Ah, crap. Not that prepared. I thought I had a here it is. Here's a link to Sotheby's.
Oh, you're way
at the very top.
David.
So it is on the 14th, so in 5 days from the moment we're recording here. But it says it seems to be the only one other than one that they have at the Computer History Museum in California. So the prototype for sale is one of only two that were ever developed, and the other belonging to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. So the centuries-old auction house accepts cash, check, or bank transfer, but only certain credit cards. I guess that's the punchline.
Oh, the irony. I have to say, I'm still surprised that after, you know, 50 years of that technology, that we haven't got multi-factor authentication to make sure that, and something more than a four-digit PIN. Surprised we don't have multi-factor authentication. My bank doesn't have multi-factor authentication, but my email does.
I kind of thought, what was it, a decade ago, I sort of thought that everyone would finally have to have their picture on their credit card. I think that was Bank of America that rolled that out and still does it.
Yeah, the best biometric in the world, as Scott McNeely said, a person's face.
Yeah, would at least be one better step. You know, I always put on the back of my credit card, too, check, like I don't sign it, I put check ID. Still, people take it and they don't ever look at it or look at your signature or anything. There's really very, very low security.
Yeah. Do you guys know what a secure ID token is or a one-time password token is?
I know Earl does. He's in IT security.
Okay.
But
well, I know a guy out here who worked for RSA up until very recently, and he ran into a customer that was complaining about how much trouble it was to use the secure ID token. You know, it's got a little tiny token. It displays random numbers that change every 60 seconds, for those of you who don't know. And one day the customer stopped complaining. And he said, what happened? You're usually the biggest, biggest complainer about all this new security, all these new security procedures, but you're not complaining anymore. What happened? And he said, oh, I found a really convenient way around the problem. I just stuck my secure, he kept forgetting a secure ID token at home or in the car, so he fixed this problem by sticking it in front of a webcam. And then he would go to the webcam and it's totally unsecured, unencrypted connection at work. Like, oh, I can get a secure ID token no matter where I am now. It's great. Three-factor authentication for you.
My wife was telling, and I don't remember the details, but my wife was telling me something because she's in IT. They have some system, Earl, maybe you've heard of this, where I think, I'm going to confuse it, but either you call a phone number or you do something, and then I think the token is then texted to you.
Yep.
And then you only have like 10 seconds or something to enter it.
I don't know if the fuse something is like that short, but using your phone and a text like to your phone as a second factor of authentication is growing in popularity.
Oh, memories of BBS callback verification are coming back to me. Oh.
Yeah, it's similar, similar situation.
How about Craigslist? Craigslist callback verification.
I have a couple of comments that I think are funny on the YouTube here. Barry says, Carrington looks different.
Yeah.
Eric actually says, Derek looks very Christian Slater-ish.
that is probably the biggest compliment I've ever received in my life. Don't even know what to say.
Yeah. And that's funny to put a face to – it's actually good to put a face to names. And I agree with that.
Yeah, we got to tell you about this year's Retro Challenge.
Very nice.
Yeah. I don't know. How old is Christian Slater now?
I don't even know who he is. I'm not a movie guy.
You did a very good impression for not knowing who he is.
It's because I stole somebody else's impression, that's why. Because I have no idea who he is.
How old? Okay, so we're getting. I know we're getting in a rat's hole, it's called. How old? So he's 43. He's younger than I am. Okay. Anyway, what was he known for? He was known for, like, what's some movies? Heathers, I know. Geez, he's been.
I don't know.
You know what's a great movie he's in?
I know him from his guest spot in Star Trek.
You know it's a really good movie he was in from 1986, The Name of the Rose, with Sean Connery. That's a good movie. See that one if you've never seen it.
Oh, okay. Have not.
All right. Earl, you take it away. You got the next item.
What's coming up?
Coming soon, the PC Retro Motherboard Kit.
Okay. So I don't know much about this company, MTM Electronics, but they have a lot of fascinating kits that they produce, like a shortwave loop indoor antenna kit and something else for doing radio astronomy. Is just like really awesome and nerdy stuff. Hmm. But one of the things that they're producing is a drop-in replica for the 5150 motherboard.
That's so wild.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Of course, you know, I was about to say, why? Stop it. Who cares? Go ahead, Earl.
Is this a full-size deal?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Sorry,
so it says more details coming December 1st, and they're a few days late because it's December 9th, but they're saying that the first production run is actually complete, and I'm pretty excited about this. I got to say, a buddy of mine and I were talking about another retro computer, and in case the idea actually comes up, I'm not going to say which one, but there was a computer that we thought, wow, it would be cool to make a drop-in replacement for this motherboard that had as many of the old components as possible, but for some of the super problematic components that you can't get anymore, go ahead and do a modern replacement of that, but it would fit within the same chassis. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially, I think, what they've done here. So if you had an old 5150 chassis that was busted, you could just buy this brand new motherboard, pop it in, and you're computing like it's 1981.
Man, I don't even know where you would begin to source those 4K RAM chips, et cetera. That's amazing. Yeah. That also brings up a point that, I don't know, I never really, Vince, but the replica Apple One kit, the function alike Apple One kit that's about, you know, business card sized and it's all on two chips. I don't know, it just didn't feel the same to me.
The replica one?
Doesn't feel anywhere near as satisfying as having a full-on Apple One board with the giant, you know, 3 kilovolt capacitor on it. ISA slots and everything. Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, I see.
Speaking of the Apple One, I mean, there are actual replicas.
Oh, yes, but I'm talking about the easy one for people like me that can't solder. That's about this
exactly.
Size.
And we don't have it in our
satisfying.
We don't have it in our items, but so maybe I'll verify this and we can do it next show. Mike Willigal, who does have a site that he keeps track of all the Apple One auctions and or ownership and stuff too. I think he's made reproduction boards. I believe he's making a new batch. So I remember, I'll put that in the show notes next time. I see the 8088 here. It looks like it's copyright until 1998. Can you guys see that? Is that right?
Yeah, Jules, that looks right.
Yeah.
It was either. Oh, I figured it was either going to be an Intel 8088 or the NEC V20, which was the. I think it was it CMOS, HMOS, some higher speed.
So they're still making it, huh?
For control systems, I guess.
Wow.
I think you still can get the V20s. And there were very, very few programs or things that they were incompatible with, but they add a couple of added instructions that let you do a couple more things.
That's right, or you used to work for Epson, isn't that right?
I did, actually.
Yeah, I remember reading that on the Retro Challenge blog, I think.
Huh, I wonder how much it'll sell for. Maybe I'll email them. We can get some more information
for
the show.
$8,088.
Yeah. That'd be the thing. How much does it cost? You know, whatever you want. What were you going to say, Earl?
Oh, sorry. No, I'm done.
We're all interrupting everybody. Okay. I'm a little rusty at this hosting thing.
Intel 8271 interrupt controller. On board. No, 8271 is the floppy driver. I got to go look it up now. Intel PC interrupt
controller.
It's
amazing you know this stuff off the top of your head. You must be a techie or something, Derek.
Well, why else would I be on this show? 8259 interrupt controller. There we go. You'll find one of those on that PC board, Trendspotters.
So moving along, the next item is, and I was very surprised that this was not, I mean, I know it's not big news for everybody in the world, but it seems like the last two big Apple One auctions kind of got fairly mainstream coverage. People are sick of it, I guess, or tired, or it's just, you know, old hat now. But
Hipster's
there was
worst nightmare, Apple One is now mainstream.
Yeah, there was another high profile, if you will. Actually, I guess it wasn't technically as high profile as a Sotheby's or Christie's auction. It was at a German auction house called Brecker in Cologne, or Köln, I think is how they say it. But it sold for it has the world record now. It sold for 491,000 and some change euros, which is about $630,000 American dollars. So that's like insane money, you know, for this thing. That's more than $500,000. Signed by Woz. I guess the biggest thing about it is that it was complete in the sense that it worked, and it came with a keyboard and sort of very time-appropriate little, you know, TV monitor, power supply, data cassette, all the other stuff.
Do you suppose this has risen in value just because of Steve Jobs passing last year?
Yeah, I think so. It seems to, because this one and the record breaker before that seems to be related, and the one before that, we're all what, 200,000, almost 400,000 now, over 600,000. It's all been since Steve Jobs died, so I got to kind of think it has something to do with it. Even though, well, I mean, obviously Steve Jobs had a lot to do with this too, but it's sort of, this is one piece of Apple history that's definitely more associated with Steve Wozniak, because he's the guy that absolutely completely designed the thing. Of course, Steve Jobs helped, hand assemble them, and he was part of the Apple company by selling them and so on. And of course, Steve Jobs was huge on the side of things to get these things sold, and they sort of launched the company. But this is all Steve Wozniak's handiwork. But go ahead, Derek.
I did hear that Steve was instrumental in getting samples of chips for no money at all.
From HP.
Woz was having trouble with I don't know if this was on the one or the two, but he was saying, can't get this SRAM to work right or whatever, but if we had this DRAM stuff from Intel, which was brand new, this newfangled DRAM technology, and that's not DRM, kids, that's DRAM, look it up, we could get this done really fast. And Steve picked up the phone, called up Intel, and there was, 16 DRAM chips on his doorstep the next day.
So certainly I do think it has a lot to do with his death, which was, of course, a little over a year now. But I have an article I'm just about to publish, and actually I published one when this was announced, and I talked about it, and I gave a little list. This is just at my blog, classiccomputing.com, but comparing sort of the high-profile auctions and then the eBay ones, and it's kind of interesting. But I'm about to publish a brand-new one where I talk about this a little bit, and then I'll talk about more on the closing, but I'll mention that again. But there's more to my article. I have an interview, too. But, yeah, the highest, I think, actually, let me look real quick. The highest any Apple One has sold on eBay so far, I think, is $75,000. So it's quite a big difference, especially now, right? $600,000, $75,000.
Well, I think we're getting to the point where you wouldn't sell one of these on eBay any longer. I mean, at this point, you need a professional auction house to take care of those kind of dollar figures.
Yeah, the last one sold in June for $75,000, and like even then in June, I'd be like, why would you sell it on eBay at this point?
You'd need like an armed guard at this point to deal with it.
I suppose you could sell it on eBay, but just to get rid of all the Yahoos, you know, you're classier than that. Take your Apple One stock and have them sort it out all for you.
But what's interesting too is that one
the price apparently $640K is all you'll ever need, because that's how many dollars it would take to buy an Apple One.
You win, Earl. You won this podcast.
The last one, so the one that sold in Sotheby's was $374,000 in June, but then there was one at Christie's in October, which did not sell, and had a minimum of what would be equivalent to $80,000 American dollars, but it did not work, which brings up a whole other discussion about, you know, working versus not working, how important is all that, you know.
You know what I want to know about these boards is I envy this person, and I don't know who this person is. Who is the person that Sotheby's calls and says, we need an electronics expert to help us carefully clean up and power up and bring up this board and verify that it's working?
Oh, yeah, and authenticate it and such? I don't know. Yeah.
Mm. Good point.
I'd like to be that guy.
You know what? I would assume Wozniak, Steve Wozniak. I was going to say Wozniak. That's why then I said Wozniak.
But yeah, straight to the source, I guess, yeah.
Well, I mean, he's reasonably pretty reachable, you know, considering, you know, big guy, you know, celebrity-dom and all that stuff. So, all right. So that's kind of cool.
I can just imagine him with a multimeter on Dancing with the Stars. You know, like, eh?
So, Earl, take it away with about Tez's continuing YouTube videos.
Tez is awesome, and he's got the Classic Computing NZ blog that I think is a must-read for anyone interested in vintage computing. But lately he's been posting videos to YouTube where he goes in painstaking detail through various computers in his collection, things like the TRS-80 Model 1 and the PET.
Ohio Scientific 1P.
Yeah, just awesome computers. And not just showing you the computer and saying, hey, here it is, and giving you a couple facts, but actually
My biggest beef on YouTube is, what we got here is my Commodore 64.
Yes.
I can kill these people.
Yeah. Yes, the camera actually maintains a certain amount of stability.
Right. Knows something about them. That's all the bonus.
And he's just got such a nice presentation, too. just, you know, the voice just gives you that, wow, this is a nice guy kind of feel. So I think these videos are really enjoyable. Wanted to send them people's way.
I just have to comment, Derek, about what's so funny about that is it so
nothing.
Hard to...
Absolutely nothing.
Is it so hard to figure out that you could, you know, sort of think about how you're going to do the video? Okay, now film the stuff you want to film. Okay. Now come in later and talk over the video.
And what you're talking about is in the title. The first words of any YouTube video, if they are, okay, so what we got here is I'm closing that video. I am not watching your video. I'm sorry.
I will counter that by saying that some of the best tutorial videos that I've seen on topics that I was interested in learning about recently, an example is JavaScript. Did have that kind of presentation, and if you can just grit your teeth and get past the fact that what you're seeing is an amateur presentation, then there were some good nuggets of truth within the video. But I know what you mean, Derek. It's like, why can't you take just a couple minutes, scribble yourself down some notes so that you're not stumbling all over yourself when you present? It's a valid point.
I'm only complaining because this is my hobby and I make the rules. So
that's fine.
And by the way, Tez is Terry Stewart, and he's in New Zealand. And was he supposed to start doing an audio podcast? Did I remember him saying something about that, or I could be mistaken?
I don't know anything about that.
RCR panelist.
Yeah, actually. There are a couple of people who have recently posted on the Vintage Computer Forum that they were interested in starting a podcast for various niche genres for vintage computing, but I don't think that Tez was one of them. I could be wrong.
And sorry, audio. Am I getting really dark? Is it too dark out here now?
You're
okay.
Are you cold?
No, you look fine. Although I forget that you are 3 hours ahead. So
maybe it's
just
the angle.
Nightfall there. No, you look good.
Yeah, and obviously it gets dark a lot earlier now. It's shortest days of the year. The sun is just now about to go behind these two-story houses over here, so I guess, you know.
You're still in focus, which is throwing me off. I'm used to seeing you all fuzzy. Yeah.
Pardon me, this is the podcast where I can do this, but sun. I saw an Ultra 60 on Kijiji, which
you're
is...
You're facing west? Oh, yeah, so that's west, by the way. Just if anybody need to know, this is west.
Very nice. Now I'm oriented.
So last item, Derek, you're going to take it all, suddenly,
okay.
Unprepared.
We'll do it live. After the thrilling conclusion of the Retro Challenge 2012, which I was unsuccessful in finding while you guys were talking, the Retro Challenge 2013 Winter Warm-Up will be running from January 1st to January 31st. There actually seem to be a few more rules this time around, so systems must be at least 10 years old.
We don't need no stinking rules.
And gaming consoles and PDAs qualify if they were made in the previous century.
Ah.
So I don't know where that leaves things like the Sharp Zorus, which were introduced in 1999 to 2001. I'm sure they could spend hours debating that, but anyways...
That's a good rule, though, so that means obviously Xbox, PlayStation 2 are out. Has to be older than that.
You know, it doesn't say previous century or the century before that. So if you had like a different engine, you may not actually qualify. Get your act together, Retro Challenge. A couple of highlights. Linux Love looks like he's going to be doing some demo programming on old Intel PCs. Luddite's going to be doing some Apple II music again, which just baffles me that anybody would do a music disc for a single voice machine, but whatever. MMFosis proves that 2008's election fever has not worn off because he is going rogue, and that is his project mission statement. Oh, and this guy, Johnny Mac user, looks like he could actually use that IBM 5150 replacement board because he has an XT5160 internet project. So he's going to have a hard disk. He'll have some place to store all that spam he's going to get once he gets that 5160 online. The PCXC online.
At least he won't get a virus.
Isn't that the most likely platform in which you would get a virus?
I don't think so. A DOS virus coming at you over the internet? That would be like a dinosaur virus hitting a human.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's
going to happen.
I was just thinking about that the other day. We don't worry about viruses these days. We worry about office macros and Trojans and social engineering and phishing. We don't worry about Win32 viruses anymore. There was an XKCD to that effect, I think. Okay. I'm going to have to ding this because this is the second time I've seen this on the Retro Challenge blog. WT has announced that he's going to be doing some networking with a MacBook 520. WT, you've just revealed your age. revealed that you're not old enough to be participating in this contest. I am sorry. You are disqualified immediately for calling it a MacBook 520.
Oh, I didn't even pick up on it.
David, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I even get pissed off when somebody says, oh, yeah, I got this Mac Pro G5 here.
Do you guys have a PowerBook 540 or 540C? Do you guys ever have that as part of your
I would have traded my right leg for one when I was 12.
Yeah, I had one at my workplace, and it was a beautiful computer.
Oh.
If I had to have a Mac in my collection, which I don't right now, but if I had to have a classic one, that would probably be a top contender.
Watch the hinges on that thing. All the 500 series. Take a screwdriver, tighten them up every year.
Ah, good point.
Yeah, that was a cutting-edge design. That whole series, you know, brought in the trackpad, I believe, right, for the first time.
At least on Apple products.
I believe there might have been some other niche machines that had it, you know, first, but I'm not sure.
Didn't they have that cool slide-in docking station, too? Don't I remember that?
The Duo docks.
That was the Duos, which would have predated the 040 PowerBooks. Duos were late 92.
Mm-hmm. Was there no docking solution for the 540? Is my
brain there were a lot. There was a Pilot third-party docking station, and there were four little tiny IKEA-like parts for each port, and you had to space them out, and you had to glue them together and screw them in. And 5 days later, if you hadn't thrown the whole kit out the window, you could just jab in your PowerBook.
That sounds very retro, if it weren't for the fact that you still have to do the same thing for a MacBook today.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen one? Have you ever seen one in real life, Earl? A Duo? And the dock and all that?
Oh, no, not the Duo.
Oh, it's I always regretted I didn't get one. They're pretty hard to come by now. I mean, you can get them, but you know, with the actual original Duo dock, because basically you would you know, it was like an early netbook, I guess you could kind of call it that. So you know, you'd put it into the front of the Duo dock and it would like at some point grab it almost like a CD or something and pull it in. And then now you have all the capabilities of a desktop computer with the CD drive and networking, plug-in networking stuff. But then when you would eject it, when you're done, it would push it back out.
So it truly ejected it.
Yeah, it would eject it.
It was a thing of beauty. James from the Retro MacCast has a video of one in action. And I remember Macworld, again, December 92, Trainspotter alert, reported, you know, beautifully engineered magnesium frame, motorized mechanism, and there's even a video card inside the thing, and it has slots. So
right.
That if you've got a grayscale Duo, you've got a full color, 16-bit color, display to work with.
So you only compromised, I guess, mobily a little bit, but it was a full-fledged, very decent, you know. It wasn't cheap, obviously, like anything Apple, but it was a pretty neat solution. Even though, you know, it was under John Sculley's watch, which obviously only crap was designed back then, right?
You're being facetious. I can tell. You've got the facetious sign.
I'm having mixed emotions right now.
All right. So we're done with the retro
challenge? That's the retro challenge, Winter Warm. And in fine retro challenge...
We'll see what he does with that MacBook 520. Yeah. We'll see how it goes.
In fine retro challenge style, Togar says, I have no ideas, but I'm entering anyway. I had a couple of ideas. One was to get a BBC Micro working over here in North America, but...
That'd be cool.
I just can't find one. There is some guy in Vancouver who has one. I got to track him down. The other idea I had was living on Mach 10, the Mach 10 Unix environment for Mac, for classic Mac OS, but again, hardware and time. And the other was living in OpenStep at work for a month. But none of those ideas have ever come to fruition.
That'd be hard. How about live on Mac OS 10 beta for a month?
You know, I reminisce about Mac OS 10.0 and 10.1, and I go, man, I don't know how we ever thought Apple was going to make this transition.
You can count on Sears for great Christmas values, like this 386SX personal computer from Packard Bell, with 40 megabyte hard drive and more, all for $21 a month. Don't miss it. Only at Sears Brand Central, now.
Mom? Dad?
Hey, it's me, Steve. This year, to avoid any confusion, I'm putting my wish list on video. All I want is a computer. Now hold on, Dad! It's just $849 for all of this. A Dell computer, speakers, monitor, 1 year of MSN internet access, an Intel Pentium 3 processor, which is awesome. I even cleared space for it. And Dell will throw in a free DVD upgrade. And Dad, I know how much you love free stuff. All you have to do is call or go online. Anywho, happy holidays, your son, Steven.
All right, so our next section is the retro computing gift idea. So something we've added since you've been on, Derek. And just the host gets this come up with these things. So I kind of cheated, Earl. I did two of them. And
it's okay.
So we'll quickly talk about them. The reason I cheat is because, you know, I think ThinkGeek is obviously a big fallback for all of us. You know, they have such cool stuff. We can't help but find things there. Because I don't know. I looked. I don't know if the last show or the one before, one of you guys just picked something from ThinkGeek, right?
The one that I picked actually went on my own Christmas list.
Well, the first item I actually bought from ThinkGeek just recently, so it is called the Arcady iPhone and iPod Desktop Arcade. So basically, it's a little, you know, I could show and tell that because it's in my office in there, but it's a little mini arcade, and you slide your iPhone in there, and then it only uses the top portion of the screen, and it absolutely looks like a little mini arcade. So it has a little... what do you call that thing? Not trackpad. The little, I'm going blank here, the
joystick.
Little gripper joystick. Thanks. It's got
Which
a little joystick.
Is this again?
Rather rare peripheral.
Anyway, so $25, you can't go wrong. It's obviously a little hard to play it. It is really small, but the whole experience is just, it's just the cool factor is just great. And anybody would love this. Or somebody that's into retro gaming would probably love this.
And that has an iPhone.
Exactly. You got to have an iPhone. I think you're limited to the 4 or the 3GS maybe. Let's see. 3GS, 4, 4S. So no 5 and no 3G.
I'm thinking you could also stick a plastic, you know, laser-etched sheet in front of it to give it that interlaced look.
Yeah.
Yeah. Authentic arcade display experience.
So while I was there, I noticed another item. So I go, what the heck, you know, we need to stay off ThinkGeek for a while. I might as well blow it for the next person. I will go ahead and mention the Iris 9000 voice control module for iPhone and Siri, which is $60, a little bit pricier there, but the impressive cool factor of this thing.
What does this do, David?
I don't know.
I'm just looking at it. I'm like, I don't think this actually does anything.
Included micro remote triggers Siri with a single button press. Built-in mic picks up your voice at a distance. Classic sci-fi styling. So basically, you can interact with your phone and Siri by way of the HAL 9000 looking thing.
It triggers the home button, and then it doesn't do anything else. Oh, okay.
Right. But have the realistic looking HAL 9000 box and eye there. So you're basically buying a pretty neat remote control little interactive. Yeah. That's kind of neat, though.
Except Siri's voice is far, far, far from the deep male voice of Hal. This is more like Haley.
That's the thing. You can't change the voice, can you, in Siri? That would be
You know what? You could pair it up with a TC Electronics Helicon Voice Live voice processor, which is a pro studio tool. You can transform female vocalists into male vocalists. I suppose you could pipe Siri through there.
Hmm.
But that's a little more than $60.
And $60 seems a little high, but, you know, I guess if it's... Hey, but if you really love, you know, the movie and HAL 9000 and Space Odyssey 2001... I'm blank, man. What's going on?
I don't know.
2001 Odyssey. Sorry.
My computer's name is HAL 9000. That's
is it really?
System name. Yeah.
Oh,
I have a habit that I like to name my computers after evil computers from the movies. I have another computer that's Colossus and another computer that's Skynet. And my wife says that I'm tempting fate, but I think it's just, you know, my way of rebelling.
We all know technology never works anyway. I don't think you're risking anything.
That's true.
So the HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey got it right. I don't know why they call it an Iris 9000. I guess you have to call it something.
Not
I don't know. The
lots.
Little eyeball looks like an iris.
That's why.
Trademark infringing name, I guess. You know what? I don't think that's got a lightning connector. So watch out, depending on how vintage your iPhone is.
Yeah, it says it's only for the 4S and 5.
Okay. 4S and the 5.
Yeah, I wonder why that would be.
5 with an adapter, maybe.
But why? I wonder what would be the problem. Oh, because obviously Siri doesn't work on a 4. Okay, I got it. It has to be 4S and 5.
Well, that, and if it's actually triggering the home button to bring up Siri, then it would have to have a connector, I'm assuming, or some sort of mechanical button. Okay. But if it was a dot connector, then the 5 is out.
Could be Bluetooth, do you think? Can you trigger Siri with Bluetooth?
Maybe. I'm a Luddite. I still had a Motorola StarTAC up until a few years ago, so I have no idea.
We're talking too current. So let's move into our retro eBay auctions, Earl. And by God, you've got an Epson HX20 listed here.
I do. Here's
is this yours?
It isn't. I do have an HX20, and that's actually part of the reason for me picking this item. It's $40. So here's the thing.
It's a nice case.
It doesn't work, but usually, and you'd be taking a risk on this, the reason that an HX20 doesn't
work. Let me guess. Clock battery.
No.
Oh.
But battery, you're very close. It's the main NiCad battery. It's interesting the way Epson made these computers, the HX20 and the PX8, both require their battery to be operational for the computer to work, period. You can't even plug them in and have them work unless the battery works.
Mac portable vibes.
Yeah.
So what you'd be doing if you bought this is taking a risk, but you would get an HX20 that you could go to Batteries Plus or some other place that makes custom battery packs and for a reasonable price get them to make you a new battery. Then if it didn't work, then oops, that gamble didn't pay off. For me, if I were to buy it, it would give me spare parts for my HX20 in case it broke down. So it's a decent price. Usually when you see the HX20s, they're much higher.
The whole thing with if the battery finally goes completely dead, the machine doesn't work at all, which the Mac Portable had that problem. It's not that uncommon for a number of different portables from the late 80s to have that issue. And I can't, the only other example I can think of, because I've had one, was a Zenith. It was a little, it was called the Super Sport, I think, but it was unique that it had a 2-inch disk drive. And finally, the one I had, the battery went completely dead, and then it was just dead. It wouldn't power up anymore. Hmm. So, and I guess the reason being is that the power obviously came straight into the battery, and then the machine actually always ran off the battery, right? So if the battery dies, then even though it's plugged in, the battery never charges, therefore the machine never works.
Yeah, you're not going to get anywhere. And
just as well, you're never going to find any of those quick disks anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And modern laptops, or even laptops that aren't so modern, have smart batteries in a lot of cases. So you can't just go make your own custom NiCad pack, a little tongue twister, and make it work. But with these older laptops, you can. Just pop in a new battery and you're good to go. I just did that on a PX8. Just had Batteries Plus make me a fresh, brand new NiCad pack, popped it in there, and bang, it was right back up and running.
Batteries Plus, I got to write that down.
We'll wait.
It could be the local shop, but I found their service to be really good. I've had them make several custom battery packs for me, custom NiCad packs, and they make them to spec, and they use the connector that you give them, or they get a new connector that's an identical match. Worked out real well. It was cheaper than a lot of the places online that were selling new old stock, and you didn't know how long those batteries had been sitting on a shelf somewhere, mm-hmm. whereas these were absolutely fresh NiCads right out of the bin.
Well, I chose not a computer per se, a computer old game. It's certainly a computer in there. But it's from 1980, a vintage Coleco QuizWiz gaming computer. This is a pretty nice one. Only has another day left, $25 with one bid. Did we mention that on... Oh, yeah, you already said how much the other one was. The Epson. But you guys remember this thing? I remember seeing them all the time in stores, and I don't know if I ever knew anyone that had one, but I remember seeing them all the time.
The closest thing I saw was a ColecoVision that a friend had down the street.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember him, David, but I was looking at it, and I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah. And, so it's kind of, I don't know what category you call this, I guess a handheld gaming. But, you know, it's not that sophisticated. Basically, I think what the deal is you buy the different cartridges or the books, and I think they plugged in. So they had, like, a little game in it, if you will, or the ROM, and so it would plug into that. And then basically you're just making selections, and then it could tell whether you choose the right one or not. So, you know, you look through the book, and you're telling it what question you're answering, and then you choose your answer. I think that's how it works.
Fun.
Yeah, the controller kind of reminds me of an Intellivision controller. It almost looks like you could slide in a different a different template depending on which quiz you were taking. But it doesn't do that, apparently.
And I imagine there's collectors out there. I mean, this is a whole genre really in itself, right, of handheld games, especially from the late 70s, you know, like the original football and those kind of things. Coleco had a line of those too. And in fact, I had the 1981 or 82, I had the Coleco version of the Mattel football one. I think it was called something quarterback. It was cheaper than the Mattel one. Earl, do you have one?
I don't.
Those?
No.
But you know, there's like tons of those kind of games around. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I thought it was kind of cool.
Hey, I got a couple of YouTube comments.
Good.
Here, David. Mike McGinnis popped in to point out that Tez's YouTube username is TezaNZ. So if you went to youtube.com/TezaNZ, which we will have in the show notes, you would find those videos that we were talking about. Rob from Switzerland tuning in, he says, it's great to see you back, David. And I'll second
that.
Oh,
good. Thank you.
Not to mention needing PRAM and clock batteries. His PowerBook G3 won't work because of the PRAM battery. And that's true. The PRAM battery would be a problem with the Macs if that clunked out.
It's not just dead or alive. It's dead, but not quite dead enough. And then you have to remove it and then test it out. And some machines work without the PRAM battery and some don't. Hmm. And is yours dead or is it alive? Get out your multimeters.
That was real common in the mid-90s there. 92 to
when, 90. When we were sure that Apple was doomed because they were cranking out absolute garbage, I still have nightmares about this lab of 7290s that I had to service.
I wonder if you can still go into Radio Shack. And one type of PRAM battery is called a 1/2 AA battery. And it's basically 1/2 of an AA battery. And so that was a real common one. And then the other kind sort of looks like a 9 volt, but it's like a smaller tiny one.
Oh,
little,
yeah,
little box.
Right.
Yeah. So
were they replaceable, or did you have to unsolder them?
Oh, no. Apple never, as far as I know, never ever soldered a battery to the board. They were all socketed.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That is nice.
Yeah.
And in the case of the box 9-volt type battery, it was just a small 2-pin connector.
Mm-hmm. And Velcroed on the board.
And my LC630, it was Velcroed to the motherboard. It wasn't soldered. Yeah.
The problem was a lot of your regular users, they didn't know, you know, their machine died and they didn't understand or realize it was that, you know, easy. I guess it wasn't that easy to a lot of people, but in most cases it was pretty easy. You know, the performance and all that, the undo two screws, slide the logic board out and replace a battery, you know, and put it back in. But I was actually a tech for Apple around those battle days, and so I was doing a lot of that stuff. In the greater Jacksonville, Florida area, like draw like a 200-mile radius around Jacksonville, Florida, and I was going 800 to 1,000 miles a week. Sorry.
Oh, man.
But if you had a Macintosh in warranty from about 1995 to 97, I'm the guy that came and fixed it. Did you know Earl?
I think that you had mentioned that, and I think you did fix my Mac once or twice, so thank you.
Yeah.
Rob wants to know, where did you get that shirt? He wants one for his son.
Where did I get it? From... you know, I had a cheat here. Retro Thing.
Online? Retro Thing?
Yep. RetroThing.com, one of my favorite retro blogs.
Very nice.
So it's not just computers, but there's plenty of that kind of stuff, just retro, all kinds of stuff.
I've seen that blog.
I think I got it 2 years ago or so. I think I wore it one time at Kansas Fest. I know, as soon as you asked me that, I'm like, oh, where was it?
I was so blank. Did I get that again?
I'm a little nervous, you know, being back on the show. Isn't that funny?
It's great to have you back, man.
I haven't been on for a while.
We love you, man.
I just got to mention, if anybody's looking for a Space Invaders shirt, I also highly recommend this one, which I got to turn my LCD brightness down.
Looks like your iPad.
So.
Yeah, I can't wear an iPad on a shirt. That's like way too heavy.
Wong, wong. So that's a little Space Invader creature on a blackboard showing a class of students.
Oh, okay.
Exactly
I get
how
it.
It's done.
Oh, that's cool.
I just can't get enough of that. There are these little infant Space Invaders that need to be taught.
Can you get a T-shirt of that?
Yes, you can. If you just search for a Space Invader instructions T-shirt, which I
okay.
Just did,
oh, and this one.
As well.
Well, I guess because it's up top, you could see where. Oh, I'm just misunderstood. Is the punchline? So.
Looks like a Pac-Man ghost.
All right, how are we doing on time? It's not quite an hour, so we're doing pretty good. Just about an hour.
Very well.
But that's pretty much for the show now, other than some closing discussion. What kind of? Oh, Derek, did you have anything? You don't have an eBay auction in your pocket you want to talk about or anything, do you?
I don't, but I have billions of other things.
In your pocket?
I set myself up for that one.
Go ahead. I just want to
mention that VICE, the Versatile Commodore Emulator Project, has just made their first major release in almost 2 years. I was just dreaming the other night. I was playing Text Adventures in VICE, and I was thinking, you know what? I'm sitting here a long time waiting for this thing to load. I wish VICE had floppy disk noises, like some of the other emulators do. And it turns out somebody actually added this back in May. Device. So I just, look at new VICE release. Maybe it's got floppy disk noises. I didn't even read the feature list. And there they were. And I got goosebumps when I heard them. So check that out.
Hey, Earl, he's a Canadian that loves Apple and Commodore. I think we found a better Canadian.
Well, at least a more versatile.
Awesome. That Carrington, he just bashes Commodore.
Yeah.
I'm a multi-platform guy. I am willing to bash TRS-80s, but I never had one, never even used one.
Why do you bash them?
Because it's fun.
I'm sorry. It's just, I just feel like whenever I see one, I got to put on like platform boots and a white disco suit because I just, it's just so dated to my eyes. Oh. And then there's the quality of the hardware, which did get better. My opinion may be changing because I hear they made a lot of business systems that, that I'm just reading about now.
I think, though, if so to defend them a little bit, I guess, is you have to consider, though, in 1977 at the time, you know, so take the TRS-80 Model 1 in consideration. If I'm off the top of my head, I think it was about $700. You know, you got a full working computer system.
Something people could afford.
With the cassette and the display. And
that they didn't have to build.
And it was black and white, and it was highly limited, but it was, you know, all things considered,
that's what I got to point out to people about Apple is nobody could afford them in the UK, where I'm talking about the BBC Micro a lot.
Or in the US, for that matter, in a lot of cases.
Well, sometimes.
They're expensive.
I tried. I dragged my dad to the store and said, I'll make you a millionaire if you buy me one of these. You have to buy me one of these Apple IIs. And he was like, it's how much? I'm like, it's only $4,000.
Yeah.
He's like, we are out here.
I know, that's what I have to tell people. Like, yeah, just because Woz figured out how to make the floppy disk system for $400 doesn't mean they actually sold it at that price.
My first computer was a VIC-20 that I owned. It was, like, super cheap, so...
My first, you know, what I consider my first real computer that was a full system, I really did lots of stuff with, you know, was my Macintosh. But so that was late 1989, and it was a 1985 old-stock Lisa.
Yeah, you know, with the Mac.
Running Mac, you know, so it was a Lisa Mac that was, you know, 6 years old and refurbished. But, it was $1,100 in December 1989. That was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I had to do if I wanted to get a Mac. There's no way I could have afforded a Mac Plus or something at the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously Macintosh's, Apple's always been expensive.
Anyways, now that I've completely derailed the ending of the podcast, I'll just...
That's okay.
No, this is freeform discussion.
Anything else?
And that's where it ended.
What are you doing these days? Now, what do you do? What is your main job?
I work in IT. At a local university, and I've been switching jobs like crazy these last few years. Right now, it's a bit of a stretch to call me a Unix system administrator relative to the really, really smart guys I'm working with right now, but that is roughly what I'm doing, supporting research networks and people. Because as it turns out, just because you know how to assemble 3,000 slices of the brain, you don't necessarily have a lot of Unix background. Sometimes you need some help. And 36 terabytes of storage, so I'm supporting those guys.
Wow, so is it a Linux kind of cluster, or using some other kind of hardware?
We do have our own cluster. We have a lot of Linux workstations. Some of them are dual booting into Windows, and everybody has their own Mac that they bring in from home as well. So my Mac background helps.
Have you done any other like broadcast or voiceover, that kind of related work?
No, you know what? I gotta get some more friends. I actually put out an ad on Craigslist in the tiny suburban area here where I live, Coquitlam, if any of you Vancouver people are listening, saying, hey, are there any other retro computing geeks out there? And I got two responses, both of which were, can you fix my MacBook?
You need an agent. And also, I guess, because you could do voice work. I mean, it's your talent. You could get an agent. And in all seriousness, so anybody who's never listened to Mac Folklore Radio, I mean, obviously you've got... No, man, it still stands as a great example of your voice work.
Oh, man, I can't listen to myself. But anyways, that's what I'd like
anyway,
to do.
Anyway, yeah, you gotta look into... I know, you know, I'm an expert on this. You got to get an agent. You could start doing more voice work, I think.
More than broadcasting, I'd love to meet some other people in Vancouver.
Contact Audible. What do you think about... I wonder what it takes to get a job with Audible.
You know, I don't know, but more than broadcasting, I just like to have some local people to hang out and do some geeky stuff with. So that's mostly what I'm doing these days, is doing geeky stuff by myself.
Right now,
I read a couple of Apple history books, and I am playing old Sierra Online games and cracking them open with AGI Studio and learning how all the scripting systems work and... thinking about doing my own game, except I have no art talent, no ideas whatsoever.
You
could
know,
be my next retro challenge project.
If you don't mind driving 3 or 4 hours, there's a monthly meeting in Seattle with the Seattle Retro Computing Society.
Yeah, the problem is I only have a 20-minute drive to work here, and that already makes me break out in hives, so I'm a bit of a reclusive.
Okay.
I am a classic reclusive geek.
Understood.
Which is why when people call me, you look like Christian Slater, I'm like... Nobody's ever complimented me like that before. I have no idea what to say.
All right, well, moving along. So, Earl, what's up? You're going to talk some more about with your daughter and stuff?
Well, yeah, so Friday night, two nights ago, we went to the local Commodore meeting up in another Vancouver, Washington.
Local Commodore meeting?
Yeah. Yeah, we have two actual Commodore meetings.
Oh, yeah,
I have to move, is what you're telling me.
Well, there's a lot of retro stuff that goes on in Portland for one reason or another, and the meeting was a lot of fun. In fact, David, I bumped into two K-Fest alumni there. Peter Neubauer and and George. Remember George, the guy who works at Intel? There at the meeting. And we had a great time.
How about that?
Hooked up at the meeting and, you know, we're chatting and lots of fun stuff going on. It's a Commodore meeting, but it's not exclusively Commodore computing stuff that happens there. People bring just whatever. So afterwards, my daughter was saying, yeah, I got to get back into some of my programming stuff. And, hey, let's go through some of your collection tomorrow. So Saturday was retro day. We were going to take the whole day and try and get through 20 computers in my collection. And it turned out that we got through four because we started programming and learning about it and having fun. And so, you know, we got 16 to go. But it was just a lot of fun. It was great to take some of these out and power them up, make sure that they're still working and, you know, like you were saying, Derek, make sure the capacitors haven't dried out. And
how old is your daughter again? I know we've asked this before, but...
Well, tomorrow she'll be 14.
All right.
And cool. Really loves the retro stuff. You know, we walk into, like, the Living Computer Museum. She looks at the stuff and is like, wow, this is amazing. This old stuff is so cool. Another thing we need to do the next time we get up to Seattle, I've been seeing postings about the Museum of Communications. Apparently there's another museum up there that has old telephone gear, and not just the consumer side of the gear, but also the central office kind of gear that you would have found back in the retro days. And I'm excited to go take a look at that.
Okay.
And that's what's up with me, and I'm going to do something for the Retro Challenge, too. I just haven't figured out what. I have, what, 3 more weeks to figure it out? So I'm going to throw my hat in the ring somehow.
And you completed last year's, I remember.
I think I actually did one, yeah. And this year, I think Derek might have given me an idea here. I've got a couple of Spectrum 128s that are in my storage area, and... in what we call the cold room. It's a room of the house that for some reason it's just always cold. And so it's a little
That's where evil lives.
That's right. So I never go in there alone. Always the buddy system.
After midnight.
There's one wall that flies are completely covering, right? And what's up with that?
You're creeping me out now, David. Stop that. So... but, yeah, I got a couple of Spectrums that were sent to me from a wonderful guy, RetroBits listener from the UK. The problem is both power and needing a PAL-type monitor to plug them in. But somebody told me that the Commodore 1080 monitor, if you adjust it just right, will sync up with PAL. So now my only problem is power and getting a cable to connect it up.
You know, me and my wife were in the Army, and we met and met in the Army, got married, and we went to Germany. We both had orders for Germany. So then we lived together for the first time in Germany for almost 2 years. And so I'm a little familiar with, you know, it was PAL in Germany. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was different, the different, you know, sockets and stuff, 220 volts. And so we had to live with that. And, you know, I know there you could buy a transformer. And as long as the device wasn't crazy wattage, like a blow dryer or something, you know, it was pretty cheap and easy to just adapt your computer or whatever. I know with PAL, we eventually bought so this is like 1991, 92, we bought a dual system television set. We had that for a number of years. Even when we came back to the States, we just used it as regular, what's the NTSC or whatever?
NTSC.
Never the same color, yeah.
Yeah, but so we had a little 13-inch TV set that wasn't too expensive. We bought, I think, and the American store, Bay store, and it was both. It was dual system. So I'm just saying, I maybe you could find a used one on eBay or Craigslist or something, and that might be the solution.
I might actually go, like, you know, the solve two problems at once sort of thing here. There are these small portable TVs that you'll find on eBay, and LCD screen kind of TVs. And
we saw at Kansas Fest, everybody was using their Apple
exactly, TVs. Yeah, exactly, these tiny little TVs. And apparently, they are also auto-sensing or switchable from PAL to NTSC.
Apparently, a lot of the equipment in Europe is. I was reading, I had to convert a PAL DVD for somebody the other day, the legal one, I hasten to add. And apparently, most DVD players in Asia and Europe are, they're mostly used for PAL, but they also play NTSC. They also convert NTSC. So it's, we get left out in the cold here.
But do they make transformers that work the other way around? I would think they do, right?
Well, the thing is, power is a challenge, but it turns out I have a power supply that has the right voltages for this. I just have to wire it up. And the connectors on the spectrum were these round DIN connectors, but they're slightly smaller than the typical DIN connector. So it's going to take a custom connector. I can't just cut up a 5-pin DIN cable and have it work because the spacing is wrong. So it's going to take a little bit of work, but that
might be a
fun
little thing. What you should do is track down one of the Sinclair portable televisions. I'm sure that would work with the Spectrum 128.
Oh, yeah, one of the little teeny tiny.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be able to read what's on the screen, but so anyway, that's what's up with me, David. What's up with you?
Well, before I say what's up with me, just to mention earlier, so the guy, the one YouTube video series, the guy's name is Matt Barton, and he does the Matt Chat, which I went blank on and couldn't remember. So he's up to 175. The current one is Quest for Glory 5. But remember, I was talking about Elite. So I think he did one of his shows about Elite. And just excellent. Very, very much worth watching. So check that out. So with me is I recently did another – I had a little bit of coverage about my whole Apple Campus 2 Visitor Center, don't say museum – idea. So that got some coverage, and I took a lot of flack in some discussion rooms. It's like, my God, these people about stuff. And I guess the only thing I'll say about it is some people just really want to hammer me about, they already said no, they don't want it. Why don't you just shut up about it or go? It's like, look, it's like television. If you don't like it, why don't you turn the channel? You don't got to read what I write or what I say. And also, you know, so I've written plenty about this, but you know, my answer to that is yes, I received a response from Phil Schiller, who is a senior VP of Apple. Huge, very important guy. What he has to say is extremely taken very, you know, he has a huge influence on Apple. But you know what? He's not Apple. He's one senior vice president. He's not the board of directors. He's not the CEO. He's not the shareholders. And so that's it. Apple has not officially said no. And they don't have to listen to me. And I don't think they owe it to me or anyone else. So I continue to sort of, you know, argue my points. But I'm about to kind of chill that out. So I wrote a recent blog article at classiccomputing.com. Check that out. I started a petition, and I decided to kill it off, even though they haven't killed it off yet. So I don't know what's going on. But I kind of decided.
They're on your side.
The whole change.org, you know, after a lot of thought, it's kind of silly and not really appropriate. It seems like change.org is better used for serious, you know, injustice and campaigns of social change and stuff, not for me to argue about Apple having a visitor center. So I decided, you know, let's get rid of that. So yeah, I wrote a little bit about that, but I also interviewed recently a guy named Lonnie Mims, and he is the local guy here in the Atlanta area who's going to co-sponsor the VCF SE, the Vintage Computing Festival Southeast, and he's got a huge collection. And he, you know, wants to start a museum, and so he also owns two Apple IIs, and he did own three. So that was, I thought, was timely with that recent Apple I auction. So I interviewed him, took some pictures, actually did video. I'm going to follow up that. So I'm going to post that tonight, in fact, on my site. So check that out. See, last thing I want to say is, the VCF SE is being pushed back. So originally it was to be Saturday, February 9th, and we need some more time. So now. Now it's to be announced, but we expect to have a final date by the end of this month or early January. But tentatively, it's going to be late March or early April now. And we don't want to push it back any more than that because, even though I don't think it's a big deal, like if we don't want to compete or like, say, the VCF East, but I don't think see how
right,
they
you'll
really
start to get into the show season, which tends to be June, July, August, September.
Yeah.
In that time frame. So, yeah, it'd be good to stand out for
And
that.
I guess technically it could come to, like, someone might go, well, gee, do I go to VCF SE or VCF East? Most people are going to be more regional and go to their, you know, the show. And that's the whole point of this is that we think the Southeast region is big enough to have to support such a thing. You know, we'd
I'd
like
love
a show,
to go to
too.
VCF Northwest. There is
yeah,
no VCF Northwest.
Right.
But I'd love to go to it.
So get it going.
Somebody do a VCF Northwest.
Well, and maybe the SRCS, the Seattle, what is it, Seattle Retro Hobbyist
Society.
Yeah, that, you know, maybe might work on that. Maybe we can be a good model for you guys.
Yeah.
So that's about it for me. So cool. Check out my blog post, please, and you know, read what I had to say in answer to some things, and especially read my interview and check it out. But now,
I'm sure if you showed up at Apple headquarters with that Apple One from the auction, they might take you seriously.
You think so?
Well, the other idea is that if you had the money to buy that Apple One, you could also throw that money at Apple and say, you know what, here's $500,000 towards getting this visitor center started.
Did you either of you guys see, so before we leave this topic, did either of you guys see the Tim Cook interview?
I just finished downloading it, actually.
VC, I guess. I think somewhere in there he even speaks to, you know, talks about, you know, which is fine. I fully understand that they're, you know, they pride themselves on being forward-thinking, innovative. They're about inventing the future. That's all cool. I just don't understand the disconnect between, like, therefore, we can never look back at anything of our
past.
That's
right. Can't you walk and chew bubblegum at the same time? I didn't understand that part. On the other hand,
yeah.
I did – one of the things that they said I found somewhat compelling, which they were saying that we believe that other people, other organizations may be better prepared or
right.
better able to preserve the past than we are because it's their core competency.
Yeah.
So that kind of made sense.
Yeah, 96 about, like, when Jobs came back, he gave all the archives to Stanford.
Right. And so just in closing that, but of course what I'm trying to suggest to them, for them to do, is not a museum. You know,
right.
I finally decided, I don't mean for you to start having huge collections of hardware and display it and talk about it and leave
Although
tours.
Although that would be okay, too.
That'd be fine, but yeah, they're probably not going to do that. But yeah, I get what you're saying, David. It's funny. I saw some of the commentary, and I actually saw the thing on MarketWatch. I thought that was fascinating. You're starting to make the mainstream press with this.
Right. But some people got really nasty, and
they did. But you know what? Just water off a duck's back, man. You just got to let it go, because who are those folks? They're just other mouthpieces on the internet. They can have their opinion, but whatever. They don't have to be mean about it.
That's what I like about the retro computing scene. I don't have to deal with the great unwashed if I don't have to. I can just sit here with my Commodore 64 and do whatever I want.
Exactly. Not get bashed.
Yeah.
Right. It's pretty hostile out there in the modern world of computing.
It can be.
So that's a wrap for the show. And what do you think? Oh, our next show is set to be Sunday, December 23rd. Do you see that as a problem for you?
No problem for me. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to wear my Santa hat.
It won't be a problem for me, and we'll see what Carrington says. And, you know, at least everyone be prepared that possibly we might move it. I guess there's at least a chance, being so close to Christmas. But but as it stands, our next show is December 23rd. You can go to rcrpodcast.com for all the links and show notes for the show. Please check out the forums at vintage-computer.com. And you can help spread the word in the forums there, other forums through tweets. You know, spread them in your own forums. Tell your neighbors. Tell the kids.
I walk
up and down the street with a sandwich board.
I so wish I had friends I could tell about.
You're breaking our heart.
I do have one suggestion.
I've only got like one or two friends myself outside of the quote unquote vintage community.
Yeah, I don't think we want to turn this into our broken heart clock.
Yeah, because they'd go, "What are you talking about, man? Old computers?" But that's all right.
I do have one suggestion for the podcast, though, in light of this IBM PC replacement board, is that if people start interrupting other people too much, David, you can just throw up your hands and go, 8259 reset, and that'll reset the programmable interrupt controller.
8259 reset. I'll try to remember
8259 reset.
It's non-maskable.
Let's see, the next item. Oh, so I would like to ask our audience, please give us a Christmas present, or if you want to be more PC, a holiday gift. And please go to iTunes right away. Just do a quick little review, or you don't even have to write a review. I think you can just like give us so many stars or whatever. But if you could give us a quick review, it would be helpful to draw attention to the show, help us grow some, help us get some new listenership. Or viewership from YouTube, if you like. So do that. iTunes. Help us out. Give us a present. Tell us you like us. You can follow us, any of us, on Twitter. There's the @RCR Podcast. Twitter feed, then each of us have our own. So there's at Carrington, there's at Retro Earl, and there's at Classic Computin. No G. That was the length limit.
Because he's from the South.
Yeah, I know. That's very appropriate, isn't it?
I'm just thinking this.
Remember, you can hear me at Classic Computin.
Got my MSI in the back of my throat.
Yeah, I gotta go down there and reset that 8259 right now. Yeah.
And feedback, we love your feedback. Send it to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Send us send us an audio clip if you like. So until next time, Retro Compute.